Welcome back to part two of a podcast. We're sort of talking to some engineers about the challenges they sort of currently face in installing renewable technologies. And I'm joined by Lara Robson, Ken Bone, and Rob Worthy. And if you haven't listened to part one, please go and do so. And this is part two. Now, Ken, we're talking about challenges that you engineers are facing sort of in, and I know obviously we've had obviously some extra ones with COVID, but what are sort of some of the challenges for you engineers in this industry as we transition to sort of renewable technology?
I know we've touched a lot about training, and one thing that some of the manufacturers have been really good to jump on over the COVID period is trying to get some online training and webinars and things like that for some for guys. And I attended a few of those, and some were better than others. So I think certain manufacturers are definitely know that the transition momentum is happening, coming. It's inevitability, really, as far as I'm concerned. We still get some of the questions on social media around, to me, very simple aspects about weather compensation, low temperature heating in general. And we know there's certain guys out there that are trying to address that in their own individual way. So I think certain engineers, certain key engineers are starting to certainly develop their own skill sets, whether they're attending training, they've been attending training on the web. But I still feel there's going to be a major shortage in good engineers going forward. We've had a few supply issues with getting some kit, but you know, that's some of that's understandable. Some of that I think could have been acknowledged and explained to us a little bit more that there was going to be issues. But hopefully some of the manufacturers are now have been inundated, or their uptake in supplying especially heat pump technologies is accelerating. They may have not been prepared for that, or thought it may come but wasn't expecting it to come quite as good as it has. Certainly the uptake for Liam, myself, and Bob in those technologies, you know, it's definitely hotting up in inquiries.
As getting hold, because this is specialist equipment, of course, has it always been a little bit problematic getting hold of?
Yeah, I would say it's always something. Well, the majority of the bits that we use, we have to order online and ahead of time. So there is always that issue with installing this kit that something you haven't predicted or something you just plain forgot to order. It's not like you can just pop down the road to your nearest merchants and pick it up, which it's not a massive thing, but I think it does make the installs more tricky, and it makes things like deliveries much more crucial and fraught. You know, we had some seam clamps that we needed for a solar PV install this week delivered to next door to the building site where we were working. And, you know, and if that lady had received the delivery then gone out for the day, that would have been it. I'd have had two guys on site entirely unable to install any solar panels because the first thing to do was to put these seam clamps on. So,
like you say, because unlike a lot of, I mean, I don't know if customers generally know this, but we're talking tens of thousands of components and parts involved in the plumbing and heating game, isn't there? Literally. And obviously, a lot of the merchants aren't stocking this specialist stuff at all.
And it impacts the prices you charge as well, because, you know, we put contingency in our pricing for those kind of things happening because they've happened to us all too frequently. So, you know, when people kind of are doing the whole, oh, this stuff's all really expensive to install, some of it is the contingency that you have to put in for delivery going to Angela at number 11 rather than the building site at number 12. So
it is some of the major manufacturers will actually work through a distributor. And take my recent projects where we were fitting some heat pump, a ground source heat pump. The cylinder alone was just under 400 kilograms in weight. Now, you can't have 10 or 20 of those sitting in the back of a warehouse ready for someone to ring up. So a lot of the distributors will only, when it comes to heat pumps, they may only order half a dozen at a time. If that dozen goes out the door in a week, which is starting to happen, they're now starting to have to change their process and therefore thinking in reordering the kit or predicting the sales that are going to be coming up in the next few months. So it's a learning curve for everybody, but generally, you know, we tend to work around it eventually. But yeah, it's as Leah said, sometimes it's the little bump in the road, the little stone, the little pebble can actually make a major hiccup in the whole process sometimes.
We can stop the job. That's the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is an issue. I mean, especially this minute in time, I don't know, I've got a couple of new solar thermal clients and trying to source solar stuff at the moment, even my the big players, I would say, like Secon, I used to get a lot of kit from. They don't seem to be of the same, oh, well, we've got it, but we might have a couple of weeks before we can get the actual bit you want. Mm. So the solar thermal side is really struggling for stuff.
I was talking to you during the week. I'm going to be doing some solar thermal episodes with some of the European specialists and experts. And that, like they were saying, some of the German boiler manufacturers, for instance, have a big, big solar thermal presence over in Europe, but over here, there's nothing. And they used to have. They did used to have, and it's now they don't. And because obviously they'll sell stuff that sells. And we're now starting to find, yeah, it is a problem. I know Eric Hawkins is talking about maybe getting some stuff organised with Newark. Newark make really, really good cylinders. And I think we might start to sort of solve this problem of getting some good solar thermal kit again.
But, cylinders is not really the issue.
No.
I mean, you can get the cylinders. It's the smaller bits you want. It's maybe a bit you need for a pump station or whatever. You know.
Even just the logistics of delivering the kit. So, you know, you take you're buying a heat pump, a buffer cylinder, and a normal cylinder from a supplier. And the project is down some silly little country lane, or not silly, but a little country lane out in the middle of nowhere. You have to tell the distributor that they need to have a smaller lorry. So the logistics levels start going up, and you have to have all this in the planning. Some manufacturers will actually give you a delivery sheet that you have to fill out. You know, is the gateway wide enough? Are there overhanging trees? Da 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 da, and it all then points to what vehicle they're going to try and deliver your kit in. When the kit is then delivered, you know, you're not going to pick it up like you would do a boiler and carry it up the stairs by yourself. You know, some of the units we're fitting, Leah knows, some of the units we're fitting are in excess of 90 to 180 kilograms in the heat pump alone. The buffer could be the same, could be 180 kilograms for a buffer. You need guys on site. You need maybe specialists lifting equipment just to get it to the plant room. So there's all those little logistic extras that coming from the boiler world, you now need to think about. And it's not a deal breaker, but when you're speaking to a client and they're saying you are expensive. Well, some of the reason I'm expensive is now I'm having to put all these things and extra ingredients that I'd never had to do before as a boiler fitter. I now have to think about a little bit more. That takes time and that takes energy. And obviously that can add to the cost.
Mm. And when you're talking about batteries, like the Tesla Powerwall weighs 114 kg. So, and that's pretty average.
You pick too many of those.
I picked that one-handed back in my day.
But even going back to the radiators, some of the triple radiators.
Triples.
You know, you try and lift a 40, 50K radiator by yourself, and it is hard work. It is hard work. I'm not putting a down on the industry at all, because it is just the way it is now. But you just have to think about these things a little bit more. Moving forward, those guys that are coming into the industry, the bigger companies have been doing it for years, they already know about it. But some of the smaller guys that are coming into the industry will need to think about some of these things as well.
Well, that's an interesting point, because once again, I'm going to keep you out there because I don't know how old you are and that would be rude, but when I started, when you started, Rob, most people in this industry were actually employed. So you had your councils employing them, obviously your big guns like people like Rich Gas and All Burners and people like this. And since sort of like the mid-80s onwards, we are now mainly over 80% self-employed people in the heating game. Now, can you see a shift where, because maybe this isn't such an easy task for your sole trader, maybe it's probably more set up for a very small little company, maybe. I mean, can you see a shift to this sort of, where we shift back from being sole self-employed?
Leah, do you want to come in on the things we've been discussing over the last few weeks? Not full details, but
we're looking currently at merging with another firm who does very, very similar things to what we do. And I'm not mentioning any names, obviously, at this stage, but it is early days. Because we want to be able to have some full-time employees because we want to train people. And, you know, that's very hard to do with a load of subbies who we have at the moment who are fantastic. And but we don't have that kind of strength of ongoing relationship that we might have with employees. So we are kind of trying to find some economy of scale, really, because then we have all sorts of advantages, like our rather large MCS accreditation cost would be then split across the two firms, our insurances, which, given that we work on roofs, we work with flammable things, we do hot soldering kind of works, our insurances are through the roof. So that's what we're looking at, because it is, I think you're right, it is really hard to, I think especially when you're trying to cover the breadth of technologies, because we're doing the batteries and the heat pumps and the solar, it's really hard to do that with a sole trader.
What are your thoughts on that, Robert?
I think, again, I found the same issue. I mean, when we were doing majorly PV, it was at the big, rush of everybody wanted to do PV. We had people, basically, a lot of excellent subbies, but wanted to take people on, but it didn't really, come to it that they wanted to be employed. That was also an issue.
I think what's coming, and I'm in discussions with various parties as well. I think there's time for not to be, as a self-employed person, not to be fighting for the same job. There's time now for maybe some collaboration. Some local engineers, some good mates, and you either create a company or you have a sort of scratch my back, I'll scratch your back type policy. I don't know, but there needs to be some collaboration, and I think that's going to happen going forward. In as you say, maybe two or three guys will start coming together and share the MCS, the processes, all that Leah's been talking about, and little firms will. Obviously, they may want to become big firms, as well. But this for a single guy is hard work. This renewable business, it is hard work if you are doing it everything yourself and trying to do everything yourself. Not saying it can't be done, and people are doing it and they're happily doing it. But I think collaboration, sort of co-ops, I think will come.
Well, I think and collaboration is key.
I think that's definitely good. Yeah,
we're going, Robert.
Got to come. It's all right. I was going to say it's got to come, basically. It's either that or it's the big manufacturers will be employing people to do the installs. Mm. That's the only other option I can see.
Well, I think collaboration is key in training. And that's, I've got something coming soon in training, which involves collaboration amongst engineers to help their learning. Obviously, I do speak to a lot of people involved in training. I've got the new standards, I'm looking for the new standards, but like I've said to everyone, it's not, I'm not really that bothered whether there's new national occupational standards. It's the delivery of training, and they're currently not getting this right, I've got coming soon, and hopefully some of my listeners have got sort of powerful positions, but their consumers might get behind me and sort of nudge some of these manufacturers to get on board with it, because in their own words, some of these manufacturers, these big ones, are like dinosaurs when it comes to actually moving in and and adapting quite quickly. They can't adapt quick, and that is a big problem. And we're talking about very, very big companies, worldwide companies, and they've got departments here, there and everywhere. And I go to them and say, look, this is a solution. They go, yeah, we really like that, Nathan, in the UK, but I've got to okay that now with Denmark or Germany or America. And it's like, come on, you know, we've got something. And that's a problem I encounter. You know, I'll go to them with a solution around training, and they go, yeah, that's great. But, you know, in their own words, they are moving like dinosaurs a lot of the time. And that's...
I have to agree. It's... I get, as you know, Nathan, I get very frustrated with today's training and even the aspects and perspective look on training of certain manufacturers. I think some are holding on by the skin of their teeth, or, you know.
Well, it has to change. What frustrates me is they've got very passionate people involved in training. You train yourself, you were a trainer for Dakin. So they got very passionate people involved in it. And obviously then they've got their structures and managements and however, but they got really no one into. So I've studied how learning works. My degree is in behavioural science. I studied how learning works, all my learning theories, right. It's a very heavily studied area. You know, education is a $1 trillion industry around the world. It's very well studied. And we've got a lot of evidence-based practice that we know about. Trying to then get my industry to listen to that. No, they don't want it. They want to do exactly the same. Get loads of people in a workshop, make the workshop look bloody beautiful. It's got everything in there you need, all the kit. Give people a load of information, lecture. Lecture doesn't work. It's obviously it's a passive thing. It doesn't engage and activate our brains. So, and then after 2 days, think they know everything about renewable technology. And off you go. It's going to go wrong. Trust me, it's going to go wrong. But what we find is good engineers are going to have to be self-autonomous learners and take charge of their own learning a bit, and that's the system I'm going to help provide them. Well, no, you were going to say?
Yeah, I think one thing I'd really like to see in training is attracting different people into the industry. I mean, my route was highly unconventional. I was, a software developer, had my kids and was interested to do something different. Now I kind of got here by hook or by crook and a bit of luck, and somebody who took me under their wing very kindly and gave me opportunities. Now there are loads and loads of young people out there who care passionately about the environment, who want to make a difference. By and large, they're going to university and studying geography, you know, or maybe they're doing engineering or something slightly more useful. And I say that as somebody who's pretty much got a geography degree. And yeah, there is so much that we could be doing to take that passion and enthusiasm. And maybe they're not going to be the people down on the ground actually fitting the stuff and being installers. But you know, the girl that we've taken on recently, she is in the office doing designs, heat loss calculations, looking at specs of machinery. You know, she's mostly desk-based because that's our need at the moment. But yeah, you could be training people who don't necessarily want to get their hands dirty, but in all the design and putting stuff together.
We've got a problem there as well, though, because we train hundreds of that. I mean, the rhetoric is that we should go into schools and inspire people to take apprenticeships rather than do degrees. The reality is we do. Hundreds of thousands of people enroll every year at colleges up and down this country on construction and building services courses. Literally hundreds of thousands. Now, what many people don't realise is they're not apprentices. So when I went to college, when Rob went to college, the only people on construction courses were apprentices. The MVQ system opened that up, which is great for inclusion. But what it's meant is we have got so many people now going to college training to be plumbers that there isn't the math doesn't add up. So the amount of employers able to take them on, and we've talked about how most employers are self-employed, they just don't exist. So every year we train hundreds of thousands of people on construction courses. They do their 2 years at college because they have to now. By law, they have to go to education until they're 18 unless it's apprenticeship. And then at the end of that, and I've seen a lot of very, very disenfranchised young people. I've had parents crying in front of me, can't they get a plumbing apprenticeship? Can't they get an MVQ? You know, I've taught a lot of students. And they just leave after them 2 years and they go on to jobs not related to this industry whatsoever. And yet the rhetoric, it's so frustrating for some of us lecturers, is, yeah, let's get into college, let's get into schools, inspire loads of people. Yeah, great for sitting in guilds and making loads of money out of certificates. That's a booming industry, trust me. Certificate companies are making loads and loads of money. And like I always say, we train people in this country to be qualified with a certificate. We're not training them to be competent. And it's very frustrating. And I think we're exploiting the young people.
But are we training them to be, are we giving them the classroom-based learning for the hands-on stuff, or are we training them to be system designers? Are we teaching them about low temp heating systems, about how AC and DC works and inversion and batteries and you put solar thermal or solar PV systems into a heating system? You know, there's a whole load of integration stuff that
they learn about definitely at level three. Okay. Now the trouble is though, colleges teach people to pass exams.
Yeah.
The Ian Gills want you to pass that exam because that's then more money. And I'm not just sorry, Ian Gills, there are other awarding bodies out there. But since that system changed, there's a lot of people getting trained. It's called the diploma. It used to be called the technical certificate, then got to call the diploma, and now get called the tech cert. They love a name change. It doesn't mean any difference though. We're also supposed to get them diploma students' work experience. We can't. It's impossible because we haven't even got the employers out there to take people on as apprentices, let alone find this massive number that's 10 times greater work experience. So yeah, they do get taught heat loss caps, they do get taught renewables at level three, they get taught all that, and then they go and bless them work in, I don't know, a supermarket or other jobs that aren't related to what we've just trained them for 2 years.
Is that's because there isn't, you know, going back to the self-employed and the company thing, companies are scared, they don't necessarily maybe want to make the commitment. It's hard to make that commitment. For self-employed, it's very hard to make that commitment to take on somebody. I've been there, I've tried it a few times, and successfully it's worked for me. It's very difficult. I think there needs to be certain areas and aspects that we need to emphasize going forward as a industry, as a country, as a renewable industry in this country. And we need to be really selling that to the younger generation. You know, this is not a boring job. This is a very, very...
They're out there, Ken. They're out there. The young people are out there. We need to be inspiring people and companies to take on these young people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I agree.
I think also Ken's right with the issue there that... I mean, you, as you know, self-employed, or even if you're I'm a limited company. Now, even if I was to take an apprentice on, that is a big thing to do. You've got big on costs. You then have to pay holiday money. You've got salaries to pay, you whatever your system is. And, you know, for the average one-man band, they're not going to do it.
But it's that leap of faith as well, isn't it, Rob? You know, are you... You get to that point where you've got too much work. I mean, I have actually tried to recruit somebody months back. I put a little post out on social media in my locality, and I got nothing. Yeah. Now, perhaps I didn't word it right. Perhaps I wasn't pointing the post in the right direction. But yeah, I was expecting at least a couple of phone calls. I'm really interested in learning what you do, can I come and work with you? But I got nothing.
Go straight to a college, Ken, and ask for a level three diploma student.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if people realise this. I mean, we are funding these young people. A lot of young people go to college, and it's over their 2 years. It's basically £10,000 funding they get. Now that obviously goes to that funding will go to the college, obviously, to teach them, and then a proportion goes to a certificate company that's basically just giving them a certificate at the end of it. And I know they do other stuff as well, but that's literally it. And we have got thousands and thousands of them, And most apprentices you'll find nowadays are actually family members. So they're the family members of these sole trades, or they are still working for, so like your big companies still take on apprenticeships. Mm-hmm. Back in the 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s, the only people in this trade were employed, and all the employers took on apprentices.
Yep, I was one of those.
Trained a little bit better because they could move around the different departments. They could be with like a master plumber. Whereas now, I mean, everyone thinks the apprenticeship is the be all and end all. No, it's not, because unfortunately, a lot of our apprentices are working with, it's horrible to say this, but they're not unqualified. They are qualified, but they don't know all the best practices. So your apprentices learn kind of bad practice. They're ballers things like you referred to, Rob. So don't ever believe that this apprenticeship is this great big wonderful thing that sort of trains people properly, because you learn a lot of bad practices if you're with the wrong company.
You learn a lot, as I'm still learning.
if you teamed up, I'm not going to tar anybody with a certain brush, but if you have gone through the process and you're now self-employed and you're now running your own company, but your particular process wasn't as good as maybe Rob's, myself's were back in the day, and you picked up a load of bad habits. You now then take on an apprentice that's come out of college, and he will pick up those same habits.
Yeah.
And so very quickly, you could have a field of engineers that might not be at the same level as another company. But they have a ticket to say that they've passed and they're qualified and they can do exactly as X, Y, and Z does down the road. And it is about quality. And, you know, I'm not harking on about it too much because it's, we'll maybe do it another topic, but you could get into that pattern. And I do feel in certain areas of the country, there is that pattern going on.
So I think that's where what you were saying before, Ken, about as an industry, it's this networked age. Networks is all the thing at the moment, isn't it? That as installers, we are now across through Twitter, through Nathan, through other things, we're now forming these networks. So, you know, yeah. Paul from Highland Heat gave me a call about a job the other day that I think, you know, you're also working
that's
on.
That's what I'm hoping to build, Lasso.
Yeah, exactly. So as we kind of grow in that, then there becomes scope for apprentices to be taken on, could even be shared across the businesses.
The people that need the money, and there's other support systems, it's not just about money, it's about training new people to be, to how to actually teach on the job. You know, you learn best in this industry when you're on the job, but none of you have actually learned sort of teaching techniques for it. So we need to support you guys doing that. I don't even understand why we have to have a certification company now. Why do we have to be paying money for paper certificates? Give all that money to you people that train people. Why do we need them? I don't think we need them. They're not going to like me for saying it. I think, you know, it's a 400-year-old industry, parchment paper.
I agree.
Qualification does not mean you're competent. It does not. And we're teaching a lot of what I call
unconscious incompetence.
We need people to be consciously competent. That certificate, and I've seen thousands of them certificates. I mean, every year, hundreds of thousands of certificates, diploma certificates are given to people. And I see it. And they get to their 20s. They might be left a bit of money. Think, oh, I've got 10 nice new shiny diploma certificates here from City and Guilds, you know, one of the biggest brands in the world. And they go and start plumbing. They get a van, they go and start plumbing. They've never worked on site in their life. It's not their fault. They're allowed to do it, legally allowed to do it.
Yep.
And we've got a lot of incompetence. And it frustrates me, as you can tell, and it frustrates a lot of lecturers. Loads of lecturers have left the college training industry because it is a conveyor belt. You know, they get all this funding from the taxpayer, $5,000 a year per student. That's a lot of students going to college. Don't ever think they're all down on university courses. They're not. They're all down. I've been sitting in Gills. Bizarrely, we had a level one course come around in 2013. Plumbing was never a level one industry. But when we made that law in 2013, so all young people now have to go to college, all of a sudden overnight, City Ingalls had a level one course for plumbing to mop up all the people who didn't have the required O levels or GCSEs to get onto level two and level three. See? And it's literally that. We could just send out certificates after certificates, and it's so frustrating. It really is. The money should be going to you lot. You know, Ken wants to take on it. Look at the people, what they would learn from you. Give all the resources to you. You know, give you the support.
Please.
Give all the support to you. It doesn't need to go to some big organisation that prints it anymore. It really doesn't. We need a paradigm shift. If we're going to save the planet, we need a paradigm shift in how training works. And people really need to start looking into colleges and what's going on there, because it's actually disgraceful. We're letting a lot of young people down, a lot of them. So that's my rant over, as you can tell. I get very passionate about
it. That's good, mate. I'm the same. Attitudes need to change from certain quarters in the industry, and upskill. As you said, I know we've gone over it again, but some people don't know that they may be at a certain level compared to somebody else. They just think the level that they are is the correct and appropriate level for what they're doing. Until they speak to guys like, you know, on the Twitters and the socials, and they're like, why is he doing it like that? Cool, I was never shown how to do it like that. And that's been good. That has been good. Those people that are on the social have been slowly coming together in certain groups and passing over their experiences and knowledges. And hopefully,
learned on social media. I mean, I'm assuming you've all learned quite a lot over the last year. Am I right?
Definitely, yeah.
And that's how we learn, peer learning, like collaboration. That's because it's never existed before. Peer, you know, social media is a new thing, isn't it? And we're all learning. We're all learning. And once again, that's what my system is going to sort of kind of utilise. I'm going to talk about control, Ken, because I know that's a nice subject. So control of heat pump systems is quite important. And various manufacturers you've noticed do it different ways. I kind of know the HVAC industry fairly well. My cousin's been involved in HVAC a long, long time. So he'll tell you he likes something like the A200 controller from Mitsubishi. It can do all these sorts of different things. You like certain control on certain brands. So tell us a little bit more about that.
I like simplistic and basic control as much as I possibly can. We try and steer, Lee has hopefully the same, we try and steer our client from having multiple differing controls trying to work together or trying to talk together. So most heat pumps will come out ready to go as weather compensated units in their controller. You can use their controller as a service tool, or you can put it in the hallway and use it as a room thermostat, programmable timer, or whatever. There are additional controls now that are coming to the market that will work in conjunction with some of the agile tariffs that we've been seeing an uptake in recently. And so certain manufacturers of heat pumps work really well with these additional controls, and it's a little bit of extra wiring, but basically the emphasis of let's pick the heat pump will then be controlled by algorithms that are looking constantly at the agile tariff and picking the best prices or the best couple of hours when the price is really cheap, and making your hot water, your unit do a hot water cycle or load your buffer tank rob or whatever. And those sort of things are starting to come. But I'm still a great believer of looking in certain size houses. I mean, obviously, I'm not talking the massive castles and mansions, but in certain size houses, almost having very limited control in the temperature I want in that house. And I don't want to be microclimbing. I don't want that room at 18, that one at 22. I'm like, let's have the whole house at 20 degrees. That's my thermal mass. Is my house is my thermal mass. We're going to trickle heat into it constantly. I don't need to be turning that zone off and that zone off here and that zone off there. And there are systems that is appropriate for, and house types that system is appropriate for. And that's just my take on how my controls are. And I've been doing that for about 10 years in that same thinking. But yeah, I like the excitement of this agile, load shifting, smart control technologies, whether it be with a house battery, a heat pump, combination of the two, or even solar thermal with, for an Iridiance meter monitors the sunlight and can see that the sunlight is really good that day, it may be able to switch the solar thermal into a different mode of, instead of doing the hot water, it may switch it into loading the buffer instead. Yeah. All these things are open door at the moment, as far as I'm concerned.
Have all the heat pump manufacturers got the ability or got the control on their units to be able to do that, or are we finding some are a little bit lagging in what you can do?
Some are still very, very far behind.
Mm. On or off?
They're not that old oil boiler of yours, Rob, on and off.
I know some heat pumps that are still on or off.
They're not going to stand a game long unless they up their game, I would imagine, are they?
No, they definitely need to move.
Control, didn't you? Your customers want that control.
Yeah, because what we're seeing with our customers is they want to have a heat pump, they might want to have some PV on the roof, they might want to have a battery, they want a car charger. We've just done just that for a customer, and they want these things to work together. And currently we're finding the My Energy sort of ecosystem is probably the most flexible out there to try and get those things happening together. So this job we've just done, they've got a Zappy car charger, so that will charge when there's excess solar PV. They've got a Powerwall, again, PV is going to charge into that, and then there's a heat pump. We're not directly controlling the heat pump in this instance, but we have got, if there is any extra after you've charged the car and charged the Powerwall, we've got an eddy from My Energy set up to take any excess into the cylinder stat. Sorry, not stat. Immersion.
Right.
Yeah, into the immersion, so that we can sort of beef up the hot water a little bit. So yeah, it's kind of looking for controls that bring all these things together and give you some flexibility to bring different technologies in, because otherwise you're sort of going down the route of a particular ecosystem, so you have to buy every single product from that manufacturer, and that gets a little bit awkward, because that doesn't always
as
work.
As we scale up, and we know we've got to scale up, sorry, I'll cut you off. As we scale up, can we see a problem with these being bunged in so quickly? They might be bunged in as they can work, but they're not actually being as optimal as they could be for particular properties.
It's very difficult to install heat pump heating system in the summer and set it up or fine tune it. We always say to our clients that, you know, if that is
go
the case,
6 months later,
we're running the system up for you now, but let's have a chat. Let's come back in maybe when the winter starts kicking off, and we might have to do some fine tuning, and then we can answer questions. But we try and set up systems based on obviously our past experience as best we can to get the system running. People just want simple controls. They don't want to be having to manually load shift or thinking about increasing the temperature, which is why I love weather compensation, whether it's for a gas boiler, oil boiler, or heat pump. I love the weather compensation process. That is just four parameters on a weather compensation curve in general, and you can set it up and generally tweak it in the winter maybe, and you can run away from it and leave it be. Regardless of any other control, it doesn't have to be connected to the internet. It doesn't have to be connected to your phone. I love that stuff. I love technology as well, but I do like the simple life as well. Mm. So some manufacturers are coming out off the shelf with PV inputs, smart grid inputs. You can connect them to eddies, solar edge inverters, all that, you know, run a cat cable in between the two and they start talking to each other. But other manufacturers are literally, as Rob said, they are still maybe on and off control. So
terrible.
There's an article recently, wasn't there, Rob, about a big company that's going to be looking at installing a million of these things, isn't there?
Well, that's right. I mean, and that was that talk about that was a bit of a paradigm shift when you said before to see this major company. I'm not going to say, you probably all know anyway, but they've suddenly come out and say, well, we just see we need to move to heat pumps. And
that was quite a shock.
Bring that all. Yeah, it was. Yeah, that was a big shock, even to me. I was very surprised.
It's good, but if we judge them by their boiler installs now.
Oof.
Oof. Boiler install isn't just you install a boiler, but you set it up. You can set it up optimally. Yeah. So Ken will set his up optimally. It'll be low flow. He'll design it for low flow temp so that it is returning much lower than 55 degrees. Where we've gone wrong in this country, in this industry, with all these boiler schemes and scrappage schemes and all these other bloody schemes we had, is people have just gone in and put a boiler on the wall and they might get back at 55, that return to temperature, which is dew point, so it starts to condense. But that's the secret word, starts to condense. It's only around about 82% efficient. So you've got the manufacturer saying, yeah, 93% efficient boiler, let's put them in. They're only efficient if you get down to like the 40s on your return temp, to be in that sort of high level of efficiency. And that's not going on hardly at all. So all these brand new boilers since 2005 going in, I should imagine, what, again, 90%? And never.
Well, I did crunch some fag paper figures once, but...
So if these big companies are sort of now in their PR machine saying, yeah, we're going to put heat pumps in, we'll put them in bloody properly, because we haven't seen the boilers going properly yet. And you know, we could have been saving so much emissions since 2005 if this stuff was going in properly, and it's quite sad actually.
But the other thing about, you know, is the grid going to melt because we're swapping from gas boilers to heat pumps? The other thing about that is everybody that does swap from a gas boiler to a heat pump is then another boiler that's not on the gas network. So if millions are going to move from gas...
I thought about hybrid boilers, and I always worry about that because...
They're going to have loads of gas left over, aren't they? I don't know.
If you're going to go hybrid, put it with solar thermal. not the gas boiler.
Are we going to mention the H word?
Oof.
Hydrogen.
You've got there.
I mean, I love the idea. I love the technology. But for me, as we put up on social the other day, it's quite energy intensive to produce the hydrogen in the first place. Now, if you can do that with renewables, and you can, then that's fine. So your renewables are effectively free. You're producing hydrogen out of it. That's great. But if you're having to put in gas, coal, electric, three times energy into the hydrogen process to get one part of the hydrogen out, I can't see that working at the moment. For the bigger, as Rob and I was discussing earlier or on social this morning, for the big industry, for the car ferries, I mean, Shetland produce so much renewable energy. They have a hydrogen plant. They pump it onto their ferries. And their ferries back to the mainland are, when they're in dock or something, they're pumping hydrogen back to the mainland, as well as they are actually plugged into electric. They're not running their diesel generators. You know, there is room for it in certain applications, in big transport, trains, ferries. All these things are still, their production, the momentum is still done by electric. But the hydrogen produces the electric that runs the motors that makes the movement.
Fuel cells and away you go. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah.
But I think hydrogen is going to be, it's going to be there, but it's not going to be on the grid, as they say.
Mm.
It's going to be a niche. It's going to be maybe used in industry for, you know, massive heat inputs at some point. And also, if we've got an issue with the grid, if you're going to start putting hydrogen into it, then there's an awful lot of pipe work that's going to have to be renewed. And the energy you're getting out of your hydrogen, you know, what is that? Probably
that's great
half for, of what you've got for natural gas at the moment.
That's great for the networks, though, isn't it? I mean, if you think about our industry, the heating industry, the networks are actually a new component of the heating industry. The heating industry is relatively new. So back in 1962, an oil boiler, for instance, would have cost you the same price as a mini. And obviously, we used to pipe town gas, and then we obviously went over to natural gas, methane. Now, that network is quite a new industry in its own right, and they want to protect that industry, because if we don't start burning gas through that network, what's going to happen to that industry?
I mean, if you want to look at it as, if hydrogen has a positive COP, then that's good. But at the moment, I feel it more has a negative COP. So if they can produce it for free and they can get it into the gas network at not much additional cost to the infrastructure, to the network system, to the upgrading of the existing boiler systems, because some people will need to have either parts replaced or have a completely new boiler to have a gas hydrogen system. So how much are they going to be? Are they going to be really expensive? Are they going to be just the same as a normal gas boiler is now in costs? If all those components came together and they said, yeah, it's going to work and it's going to cost X, Y, and Z, and it's, you know, it's going to be actually cheaper than money in gas or whatever, then fine. I'll be happy to accept it as a system. But at the moment, That might be 10 years or 15 years down the line before we hit that sort of point.
Well, I think that's the issue already. They're saying it's 10 years before even we'd be close to hydrogen, and we've got to try and get to net zero a lot earlier than the time they're giving us. So the easiest way, the quickest way, is using heat pumps. The hydrogen setup, you know, just it's a non-starter in my mind.
Yep.
Which is why all this low flow temperature heating is the key, isn't it? Because whichever way your particular house ends up, whether it is some kind of a hydrogen mix boiler, whether it is a heat pump, it's got to be low temperature. So it feels like this huge training mountain that we've got to climb. The foothills of it are all about the low temperature heating, because you know not everybody is ready to put in a heat pump yet. They might have insulation needs, things that need to be improved in their house. They might just not be confident with the technology. But if you can say, okay, well, we'll put in a new gas boiler, but at the same time, we'll look at your pipe work, we'll look at your rads, we'll make sure we put the right gas boiler in. If you're already running low temperature, then you're heat pump ready, aren't you? And I think we need to, or you're even hydrogen boiler ready, because they're not as powerful.
Yeah. We don't tend to enough in this country think of a heating system as a system. We always concentrate on the heat source. So obviously it's been the condensing gas boiler for the last 3 decades. Now it's heat pumps. We're not actually looking at the system. And Ken's mentioned this before on one of the podcasts we did with Richard. You know, why don't we just go into people's houses now, right now? We've got to get these problems solved. Weather compensate them, get them, do a heat loss calculation on all properties, weather compensate them, because that's not going to be disruptive to the consumer. And that's going to reduce CO2 massively. Right? But while we're having this discourse for like year on year on year on year about we've got to act now, we've got to act now, and like 15 years later, we still haven't really acted, we could have been saving so much emissions by just getting what we've got working optimally. And we're not doing that.
This was my point going back all those months ago. It's just like, the technology's been out for 15 years plus, weather compensation in domestic gas boilers. Why weren't we fitting them as standard practice back then to every new boiler that was installed? And then all of a sudden Boiler Plus came along, and that was meant to be the game changer to CO2 emissions, and I just kept on doing my weather compensation thing. It is very difficult to go forward. I think some guys we need to change the infrastructure. We need to change the process. So every time you do a gas boiler installation, you have to do a full heat loss. I know we've talked about this in the past.
We're up against it though, aren't we? Because there's a lot of marketing and PR in this car. I mean, I don't know if many people know how the heating industry works. There's a lot of PR now and a lot of marketing. I mean, you've got boiler companies flying people around the world if they sell so many boilers. And that doesn't really make sense. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be an industry that's supposed to be reducing emissions, and you've got boiler companies saying, well, if you hang so many on the wall, we're going to fly you to an exotic, and then they do it year on year out. And it's not me just saying, I've actually been asked that question. Why are boiler companies doing that? That doesn't make a lot of sense. Now that also causes a problem, because you'll get companies think, well, I'm not going to repair that boiler today, I might as well just sell a customer and need a new one. So they're taking out boilers that can actually be repaired. Rob and I come from that generation where you fault found and you repaired something, because now a lot of stuff is just taken off and a new boiler on the wall. Because they get their points and then they can get flown to wherever these exotic places are. That's not inspiring the engineer to be an engineer. That's just inspiring someone to just take something off and put something on.
Shifter.
Yeah, but what's really encouraging is that the thing that has definitely, definitely cut through to consumers is this no more new gas boilers from 2025.
Yes.
That figure has created an awareness amongst, I would say, getting towards Joe Public, that gas is on its way out. So if you're then as an engineer going in and saying, well, I know you're more comfortable having a gas boiler and you're not ready for a heat pump, but you're already aware, because you came to me saying that you're already aware that gas is on its way out. So let's make your installation heat pump ready, so that when you do feel a bit more comfortable, and maybe, it feels like a long way down the road, you're replacing that boiler, you'll be able to do it.
We are going to allow hydrogen ready boilers though post 2025. There's probably a little caveat that if it's
But why are we selling conventional cylinders now? Why can't we just sell a cylinder that's a high gain cylinder that's ready for heat pump ready? There was a comment on one of the socials. He's like, why are you fitting a conventional cylinder when a renewable cylinder is about the same price and it's heat pump ready? Yeah. So you need that cylinder replacement in an emergency. Don't buy that existing boiler cylinder, buy the heat pump ready cylinder instead. That people are starting to change. The customer's expectations are changing. Some obviously the reactive works is very is a very dangerous territory. You know, my boiler's broken down, I need something really instantly. Yeah. They're not going to say, oh, I'll wait for 3 days for you to do a heat loss calculation just to make sure that, you know. I mean, I used to just get the smallest boiler I could get off the shelf for most houses up to a 5 or 6 bed. And, you know, if I was in that position, because generally most of the boilers were oversized.
I mean, that's an important point you pick up on, Miguel. I don't want engineers out there, because there are good engineers out there, I'll never blame engineers, who know that their customers can't afford all this stuff. They can't sometimes even put in the quote for that heat loss calculation in some ways. And we'll just put them a boiler in, keep them comfortable, keep them warm, keep them alive in some cases. You know, if you've got people in their 90s stuck out in the sticks, most of my dad's customers are very old, you are literally keeping them alive during the winter with that boiler.
They tend to be more durable than us young uns, though.
Hey, I grew up with frost on the inside of a window. Don't worry.
Yes, so did I. And my grandfather helped bring heating technology to this country, but I was still there. Well, it's been a great, great episode, this one. Obviously, I've got quite passionate about the training side of things. We've all had a good chat about other things as well and some of the challenges we all face. And we'll probably be chatting to these three again, no doubt, pretty soon. So I'd like to thank all my listeners. Please subscribe to this if you're listening on Spotify and iTunes. I think you can subscribe. There's ways you can do that. You can follow me on Twitter, Beta Teach. And I'd like to say a big thank you to my guests. We've got Rob, we've got Ken, we've got Leia. And I hope to... Is anyone going to the pub, by the way, tomorrow?
No chance. I'm in lockdown still.
Isn't this historic? I mean, pubs have been around in this country for, 600? I was saying to my daughter's mum, because she's been invited to go to a pub with a friend. I'm saying, this is one of the most historic events ever in human history, I think. The fact that a pub in Britain has been shut down for so long across the board. That's never happened before, for a start. And then now this one big day, it happens to be July the 4th as well, everyone's going to converge on a pub. It's quite strange.
If it's anything like the beaches, I'm definitely not going to be attending.
I think we're of like minds there. Crowds, I don't want to see people.
I'll be drinking my gin and tonic to celebrate my American friends at home. At least I can trust the ice. I never drink ice in a pub because I know our ice machines are plumbed up. Right, thank you everyone, and be safe and see you soon.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Thank you.
Cheers.